one morning early, I took off from Lee Field in a plane in order to make inspections of our four outlining training fields. One was at St. Augustine, one at Palatka, and the other two in remote locations, not near any town. Paragraph. After taking off, I circled the field gaining altitude before taking my departure. I looked down and saw three crashed planes on the runways or near there too. I landed immediately and proceeded to the engineering office in the hangar. I asked to see the engineering and plane logbooks of the crashed planes. You keep a logbook of every engine and every plane and with the accessories, what repairs are made, what maintenance is made, when it was made, and who by whom it was made, as a matter of records. After making a survey of the situation, I directed that the field be closed to all outgoing traffic and collected as many of the plane and engine logbooks and records of the 20-hour maintenance checks which were performed routinely, as I could carry out, and took them to my office. For several hours, I pored over the entries in the logs and the 20-hour check forms. It was our custom to give an engine check every 20 hours. All checks were made at night in order to increase plane availability during the day. Paragraph. After several hours researching alone, I called Rear Admiral McFaul, commander of operational training, that afternoon and told him that Lee Field was closed and I proposed to keep it closed until he could send a team down to investigate me. At 0800 the next morning, six members of his staff appeared in my office. The group was headed by a commander in the regular Navy who was an aviator and an aeronautical engineer and stood in the top four or five of his class. I turned over to them the logbooks and check forms in my possession and offered all possible help in that investigation. They spent a couple of days down at the hangar, checking planes and going over the records as part of their investigation. The result of that investigation was a shocker. During the night inspections, no officer was present, only petty officers were in charge. Planes were brought into the hangars and checks forms were signed off as having been fully inspected when, as a matter of fact, the prescribed checks had not been made in many cases. Men would secure early and the planes were moved back on the line, certified, ready to flight the next day.
Despite all the crashes they'd been having, they didn't...
I'm telling you like it is. This report resulted in outright antagonism on the part of the two Navy commanders in charge of my two training divisions. I realized then that either they would have to be relieved or I would have to ask to be relieved. The action which I took was to go to see the training officer on the staff of Commander Operational Training Command, then Captain Edgar T. Neal, we call him Greasy, and asked that the two commanders in question be detached from my command. I also asked that the next senior, who was a lieutenant commander in charge of the safety program, be detached. Period. His only question was, who would you get to replace them? I replied that for the time being, I would use the officers already in my command, and mentioned two lieutenants who had served in fighter squadrons on carriers. Their names were Lieutenant Charles F. Moffat and Lieutenant Wilmer F. Roy, R-A-W-I-E, Will, we call them. Although they would be filling commander's billets, I felt that they could do the job. Charles Moffat was the son of Rear Admiral Moffat, former chief of the Bureau of Aeronautics, who lost his life in the crash of the dirigible Akron. I told Greasy that I intended to work with him as much as I could, particularly during night operations. Furthermore, I asked that one commander with combat experience in a carrier fighter squadron be ordered, when available, to head up both units. I had someone in mind for the job who had been in the South Pacific with me. It was Commander J.C. Clifton, Jumpin' Joe, as he was known to all. Joe had been an air group commander and had flown Corsairs in combat. He had also been my friend at the U.S. Naval Academy and a football great. He was gung-ho and can-do all the way. Detachment orders which I had requested were forthcoming promptly, and Charles and Will and I put our heads to the hand to the plow to try and get things straightened out. Several months later, Joe Clifton arrived in Jacksonville. My first contact with him was when our cars passed on the road between Lee Field and Jacksonville. I was headed for Jacksonville and he was headed for Lee Field. We recognized each other in passing, stopped our cars, got out, had a chat along the roadside. First thing he said to me was, "You don't need to tell me a thing. I've been thoroughly briefed and know what your problems have been. I'm mighty glad to be here working for you." Will Roy and Charles Moffat had done an excellent job under trying conditions. They were juniors to several officers in the training units, and the detachment of the three senior officers in the training group had naturally left some people who had been loyal supporters with their noses out of joint, so to speak. Nevertheless, with the improved aircraft maintenance that was initiated, the casualty rate had shown a marked improvement, and I was confident that with Joe Clifton in the saddle, it would improve still more. Joe was a leader of men and the best morale builder I've ever known. His enthusiasm was so contagious. He had a tough, rough time getting through the academy. In a class of 402 graduates, he stood 14 from the bottom of his class. His approach was a positive one. when discussing an intricate maneuver of dogfighting with his students, his approach would go something like this. Now, that's the way it's got to be done. And don't tell me you can do it. Damn it to hell. I'm dumb. And I can do it. So if I can do it, you can. Now get up there and do your job. They ate it up, and morale began to soar. From that point on, I had no more problems about our trained program. No more qualms, rather. And then find time to devote my energies toward improving the recreation facilities and station morale in general. As I mentioned earlier, the nearest extensive recreation facilities for both officers and men were in Jacksonville and St. Augustine, both about 25 miles distant. And there was no commuter transportation in existence. The greatest need we felt was to try and get all hands interested in some sport providing physical exercise. We were fortunate to have as athletic director an outstanding reserve officer named Hugh Ewing, E-W-I-N-G, Jr. He organized softball leagues in sufficient numbers to include everyone on the station, male and female, student officers, station officers, and civilians too if they chose to play. Also, bowling leagues were organized. I participated in both. In addition, emphasis was placed on developing a station team which competed with other stations in the Operation Training Command, as well as some Army base teams. Much enthusiasm was generated, and rivalry was particularly keen between Lee Field and nearby Cecil Field, which was an auxiliary air station in the same category as Lee Field. At that station, dive bombing and scout bombing bomber training was conducted. The CO was a classmate and a friend of mine, Commander Samuel G. Mitchell, Pat, as he was known. The intense competition between Lee and Cecil Field was not limited to sports, but each command was to make theirs the showplace of the operational command. Pat and I were detached from our commands at about the same time, and each of us assumed command of a training carrier on Lake Michigan, where the rivalry became more intense than ever. More about that later. Paragraph. As soon as I was able to give it some thought, I called in my public works officer and gave him a project of building a patio adjacent to the ship service store for use as a beer garden for all hands. It was strictly regulated, the hours were, and profits would go to the ship service store for use of all personnel. Ship service funds were to provide a number of recreational projects designated to make for a happy ship. It was noted that garbage trucks from St. Augustine were making daily visits for the collection of garbage from the general mess and the BOQ. I learned that a sizable sum was being put out for the service. The call occurred to me, why don't we start a pig farm and save that money and have pig picking barbecues for all hands? We did just that by fencing in an area, buying two or three brood sows or boar, and let the nature take its course. In a short time, the picnic area which we had built along the river was crowded with personnel on weekend, and the barbecue pits were steaming with shoat cooking. The spits, shoat cooking in the spits. Those picnics were for all hands, and the general mess made that contribution by providing the food equivalent of an evening meal for the picnic. The venture was a great success. One thing Lee Field had in abundance was land. Some of it had been farmed before being taken over as part of the reservation. One day I was talking to Mark Matheson, my exec, and Hattie, my secretary, when another brainstorm developed. Since our pig farm was such a success, why don't we use some of this farmland for truck farming and give the produce to the married enlisted personnel having to live off the station in the light line area to pay rent? Hattie said she knew of a colored man with a plow and a mule who was available. So our truck farm was born. As produce came in season, corn, potatoes, beans, and watermelon, so forth, well, right. We erected a stand at the entrance of the field and stocked it daily with bags of produce and invited enlisted personnel living off base to pick up a bag on their way home after work. Parenthetically, I might add off the record that I broke the regulations there because I had some irrigation put in to make sure that our farm was productive.
Did the personnel work the farm themselves?
No. The ship service paid for the mule and the plow and the colored man
and he
to
did
do
all
the farming.
Work down
the farm. But I had a little irrigation in on the side, which was sub rosa. And I never put that in the record. During my 14 months at Lee Field, we went through two hurricane seasons, and during each season we had to evacuate all planes that could not be put in the hangar. Our hangar was large, but it was normally used only for planes undergoing repairs or maintenance. All other planes were tied down to cleats in the on the concrete apron adjacent to the hangar. So, when the hurricane path threatened, everything outside was evacuated to another base. During the second season, after evacuation to a base we considered to be safe, the path of the hurricane changed abruptly and most of the planes had to be flown to other bases. Our training was disrupted for about a week during that operation. Cecil Field was visited by a twister and 35 planes parked on the apron were damaged or destroyed. Fortunately, Lee Field escaped that one. Jacksonville is the gateway to Florida and it had at that time, probably does now, a rather unusual distinction as a convention city. Just as surely as the migrating birds fly south in the fall and return to their nesting ground, the gays did the same. In the fall, they convened at a certain hotel in Jacksonville, set up a maypole with streamers of various colors on the hotel ground, and frolicked about before spreading out to their favorite stomping ground. The same procedure was repeated in the spring before returning to their respective nesting ground. No wonder Anita Brown had had her hands full. Green Cove Springs was also one of their favorite spots. One Saturday night, Mark and Pride Matheson, Betty and I decided to drive up to Naval Air Station Jacksonville and have dinner at the Officers Club. Mark was in front with me, our wives were in the back seat, and as women sometimes do, were discussing the latest tidbits of the local gossip circuit. Mark and I perked up our ears when the name of the lieutenant who managed our bachelor officers' quarters was mentioned as possibly being involved with other officers in a gay way. Paragraph. The next morning, Mark and I discussed the impact of the current gossip and I decided that it was definitely in the interest of morale to have the matter cleared up by getting the facts. I called the intelligence officer on the staff at Jacksonville and told him that I might have a problem and asked for a naval intelligence officer to come down and investigate. He was very experienced in that line of work and asked to be put up at BOQ for a few days. He further stated that by mere observation, he could spot a ferry about 9 times out of 10 just by looking and observing him. A couple of days later, he came to see me and said he felt sure that the BOQ manager was a homosexual. So a plan was devised to get the evidence on him. His room was searched and the evidence needed was obtained. I immediately had him transferred to Naval Air Station Jacksonville and relieved from all duty. I later talked to him in Jacksonville and told him of the evidence we had, and he readily admitted that he was a homosexual. He seemed to be proud of the fact, considered himself to be superior to normal people. I told him that he could either submit his resignation from the Navy or I would recommend him for general court-martial. He submitted his recommendation, period. In parenthesis, I might add here that last week, Betty and I went to New York and arrived on Sunday before the 4th of July. And she was there for a national portrait seminar, which lasted a week. And we took a walk down Fifth Avenue en route for luncheon at the Modern Museum of Art. The streets were lined on both sides. We wondered what was happening. Soon we heard noises and found out. A procession had blocked off Fifth Avenue for 4 or 5 miles. 100,000 gays were marching down Fifth Avenue, and you've never seen anything to equal it in your life.
It was on television, the one in New York and the one in California, San Francisco.
We observed. It was the most disgusting scene I've ever witnessed. So much for that. Paragraph. Most of the officers stationed at Lee Field were reserve officers who had entered the service as volunteers with the intention of serving only for the duration. Quite a number had been trained as Air Combat Information Officers, for instance, ACI. And they were a hand-picked group. Many were from Ivy League universities. The group had been organized and trained as a special project of Rear Admiral John H. Towers, Jack Towers, Naval Aviator No. 3, when he was chief of the Bureau of Aeronautics from 1939 to 1942. During that period, Rear Admiral Jack Towers, later Admiral Towers, expanded naval aviation for 40 times its pre-war strength in personnel and 25 times in aircraft inventory. Since many of those officers had been trained to serve in combat units, I made it a point to let each one know that I would arrange to have anyone desiring combat duty to be transferred to such a unit when he wished. I did not want them to have to tell their grandchildren that their service in World War II had been confined to the continental U.S. So far as I know, all requests for combat duty were granted. The command of the Naval Auxiliary Air Station Green Cove Springs, Florida was a demanding one, but also rewarding in some ways. As I have stated, the most difficult part was having to write letters of condolence to the parents of those brave and outstanding young men who lost their lives while training for one of the most hazardous aspects of aviation, combat. Nevertheless, there was some consolation in knowing that when I left for my next command, the casualty rate among the student pilots was less than half of what it was when I took command. I had kept a monthly chart showing what the rate was. In October 44, Some 14 months after I took command, I was ordered by Commander Operational Training to proceed to Chicago and take command the training carrier U.S. Sable, based at Chicago, which was also under his command. When I went to Lee Field, when I went to see him just prior to my departure, he said, "Bill, I want to apologize for having to send you to Lee Field. At that time, it was the most inefficient base in my command. Now, if it isn't the best, it is certainly one of the best," unquote. I thanked him and made my goodbyes to Rear Admiral McFaul and his staff. That night, the station's officers and their wives gave a farewell party for Betty and me. They presented me with a lovely cocktail shaker suitably engraved. The next morning, we took our departure and pulled out in our Chevy, and we had gone only a quarter of a mile when I heard a Jeep approaching at high speed, and then heard it beeping, period. Pulled alongside and stopped. Out popped Hugh Ewing, the athletic director. He presented me with an autographed softball which said, "Commander W.H. Ashford Jr., Pitcher, Base Administration." It was filled with the autographs of members of our softball league. I still have the ball. Period, paragraph. My orders gave me a few days' leave in addition to travel time, so Betty and I headed for the Cloisters Hotel at Sea Island, Georgia. When we arrived, we were delighted to be welcomed by Margaret and Lee Spruance from Greenville, Delaware. Margaret was the daughter of Admiral and Miss Halsey, whom I had known ever since Pensacola days. Betty and I had been entertained previously in their Greenville, Delaware home. At dinner that night, Major Dick Richardson, Dilworth, U.S. MC Reserve, and his wife came over to our table for a chat. Dick had been ACI officer on Admiral Halsey's staff in the South Pacific with me. He now had I had known him well. His new billet was officer in charge of the radar stations in the area. They were living on Sea Island and invited Betty and me to join them on a family picnic with them and their children on Sunday morning at Jekyll Island. That picnic was a memorable experience, period. We took off from Sea Island in a Navy motor launch and landed at a broken down pier leading to the old boathouse on Jekyll Island. Jekyll Island at that time was owned by the Jekyll Island Club. There were only two occupants on the island, the caretaker and his wife. No club member had been there for many years, yet the club met once a year in New York City and appropriated the fund to pay the caretakers. It was reported that before the turn of the century, the members of the Jekyll Island Club, some 60 in number as I recall, controlled through interlocking directorates 97% of the corporate wealth of America. We walked around the grounds and saw the cottages of the the Rockefellers, the Vanderbilts, the Arthur Curtis James, and others. In a large garage, we saw a number of little red battery-driven carts about 3 feet high holding two people, which were formerly used for transportation. In the cottages were more like mansions. The furniture was all in place and everything was in order, at least as far as one could tell from peering through the windows from the outside. There was a golf course bordering the sea, a skeet range, and miles of beautiful windswept beaches. The caretaker took us into the Jekyll Island clubhouse. Silver and linen were in place, and all equipment was intact. It appears that a banquet could be held there on short notice. After our tour of the island, we came back to the boathouse and had lunch with the Dilworths and the children. No outsider was allowed on the island, and it was only because there was a radar installed there under Dick's control that we were able to go. It was an interesting trip, but it gave one something of the feeling one gets when one sees the opulence of former years, such as in Pompeii and now in Newport. To see that beautiful island going to waste seems so unnecessary. A few years later, the island was taken over by the state of Georgia. A causeway was constructed connecting it to the mainland, and a development program designed to preserve the best of the past and to develop for the future generations. And a development for future generations was instituted by the state government. There, 30 years later, Betty and I spent a week there, and it was a joy to see how much the controlled development program of the state, how well it had worked out. Many of the original buildings had been restored. The wetlands had been preserved. A bird and wildlife sanctuary had been created, and building along the beaches was strictly limited. Outside of the Rockefeller Cottage, the first telephone installed in the United States by John Rockefeller Sr. was standing in a booth on the lawn. The phone originally was wired to New York City and San Francisco. Paragraph. After retiring from the Navy, I called on Dick Dilworth when he was mayor of Philadelphia. While mayor, he was the guiding force in restoring the mall leading from Independence Hall. He and Ms. Dilworth both invested in property in the area. Later, Dick ran for governor of Pennsylvania, but was not elected. He is a member of the Yale Corporation, and his present position is that of manager to the entire Rockefeller Family Trust, variously estimated to be worth several billion dollars. Paragraph. A few days spent at the Cloisters with the Spruances and their friends were most enjoyable, and ended all too soon, as we had to move on. After stopping to see my father in Watkinsville, Georgia for a night, we proceeded on to Chicago. And with that, I will close my fourth interview.
And this is in October of 1944 that you're moving from Florida to...
October of 1944. I've just...